loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, a U.S. District Court judge in San Francisco has blocked President Trump's plan to phase out Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, because of the president's tweet supporting the program. It's Trump versus Trump on DACA. Next, former presidential advisor Steve Bannon has stepped down or has been forced out as the executive chairman of Breitbart News as the fallout continues from his sharp attacks on President Trump and his family in a recent book. Then, at least 15 people have been killed in the exclusive Southern California enclave of Montecito after mudslides triggered by heavy rains followed the worst forest fires in the state's history, which destroyed roads and houses. Yet many Republicans still deny the effects of climate change. And then President Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen, filed a federal lawsuit yesterday against the news organization BuzzFeed and against Fusion GPS over the allegations contained in the Steele dossier. Finally, Bruce Gagnon and 11 other protesters were arrested a year ago for blocking the main street leading to the Bath Iron Works shipyard to protest the christening of a U.S. Navy destroyer. Their trial starts soon. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first we turn to DACA. A U.S. District Court judge in San Francisco has blocked President Trump's plan to phase out Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals because of the president's tweet supporting the program. So now it's Trump versus Trump on DACA. We're joined from New York by Angie Kim. She is an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minh Quan Center for Community Action. Angie, thanks for being back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Angie, CNN is calling the state of play on DACA, quote, a mess, unquote. We don't know where Donald Trump stands on DACA. In 5 minutes before news cameras yesterday, he took three different positions. Can you offer our listeners some insight into this?
Absolutely. I think mess is might be an understatement, actually. I think President Trump obviously ran his campaign on his promise to eliminate the DACA program. And he has taken on several different positions since he took office. His administration obviously ended the program on September 5th of 2017. And with that, kickstarted the end of the program, which Dreamers are no longer able to benefit and apply for the program. And since September 5th, the DACA recipients have began to lose their status according to their individual expiration date. Since then, President Trump had taken on basically two opposing positions, which is He initially had a conversation to cut a deal with the Democratic leader, with Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, of the Speaker, and said that DACA has to be part of a bigger immigration reform that holds a lot of anti-immigrant agendas. Yesterday, in the meeting, he has taken on a very different position, where he is now the sort of taken on a position of this leader on a bipartisanship to pass an immigration reform that includes a solution for DACA recipients. So he is not upholding to any particular position, and he's just going back and forth on this issue. So you're right. It's very irrational, erratical. He's completely unpredictable.
Angie, I was fascinated by the district court judge's decision. In a 49-page order, he wrote this, and I quote, this is from the Washington Post, "We seem to be in the unusual position wherein the ultimate authority over the agency, the chief executive, publicly favors the program the agency has ended. For the reasons DACA was instituted and for the reasons tweeted by President Trump, this order finds that the public interest will be served by DACA's continuation." So it's as though, not even as though, what happened here is that the judge went back and read the president's tweets And the judge actually quotes two tweets, one from September 14th of last year, tweeted at 5:28 a.m., I might add, where the president says, "Does anybody really want to throw out good, educated, and accomplished young people who have jobs, some serving in the military? Really!" Exclamation point. And then followed up with a second tweet saying, "Congress now has 6 months to legalize DACA, something the Obama administration was unable to do. If they can't, I will revisit the issue!" Exclamation point. Well, it's like the judge is taking the man at his word and saying, "Fine, you want DACA? I'm going to give you DACA." And there it is.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump's tweets about the Muslim ban were, you know, central to the court rulings.
That's right.
His intent was to actually ban Muslims, even if he threw North Korea in there.
Vladimir Putin said that the Russian government reads Donald Trump's tweets as policy, as U.S. policy. Well, why wouldn't a U.S. district court judge do the same thing?
Angie Kim, we're just getting also a break. This is Brian Becker here. We're getting breaking news that, as I'm sure you've heard, immigration agents raided dozens of 7-Elevens as the Trump administration moves to crack down on businesses with undocumented workers. 100 convenience stores across the United States were raided this morning.
Because that's where the problems are in our country, at 7-Eleven.
It's just a war. It's a war against immigrant families.
Yeah, I mean, this is as inhumane as it gets. It's a direct attack on immigrants. There is no preface or any backstory to this. They're just raiding, you know, anyone who is without documentation. You know, this is something that we have been fearing for a long time. This is something that the undocumented, you know, communities have experienced for a really long time. I don't know what more we can say. I've said it again and again that unfortunately, you know, I think a lot of this conversation in the in Washington and a lot of these conversations that are completely politicizing the issue have really shadowed what the undocumented communities experience every day. And that is, even though we are having this conversation and it seems like we are moving in the right direction towards fixing the immigration issue, the truth of the matter is that in the shadows, undocumented individuals and families are being, broken apart. People are being raided in their homes, at their workplace. People who are not a threat to the country are being arrested without reason and a fair trial. And that's the truth. And it's unfortunate that a lot of these incidents are being overshadowed.
And it also seems to me that the Democrats have been completely unreliable. They want the Latino and need the Latino vote in particular, but they also need the vote of other immigrant communities. So they want people to vote for them. But when push has come to shove, each and every time, and this goes back all the way, I would say, to 2006 and 2007, when it looked like comprehensive immigration reform was about to pass. Nearly passed, and that would have been the biggest, you know, update on immigration since 1986. The Democrats, one, either didn't have the votes or certainly didn't do what they might have done using their positions of authority and positions of visibility to be the mobilizers of millions of people who would have answered the call to come to Washington and stay here until comprehensive immigration reform gets done. And of course, you and the other Dreamers, you know this firsthand because it was your actions that prompted even the Obama administration to take the action that it did take. It wasn't like a gift from Obama. That was the hard work and the courage of the Dreamers themselves. In our last 90 seconds, where do you think we're heading in terms of the possible, because the court decision will be heartening to people, is it possible that the mass immigration movements of a few years ago could be coming back into the streets?
I think that's a little unlikely. I think at this point, the ball is really in the Republican Party's court. If we do pass a really bad, there wouldn't be anything comprehensive of any reform if it's passed, but it surely will be, the work of the Republicans at this point. You're right. You know, when we have the chance, we couldn't pass anything comprehensive. And right now, we're not really in a good position to have a really good leverage. So it's a stretch to say that we can have a very progressive, comprehensive immigration reform at this point.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from New York by Angie Kim. She is an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minh Quan Center for Community Action. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Former presidential advisor Steve Bannon has stepped down, or has been forced out, as the executive chairman of Breitbart News. As the fallout continues from his sharp attacks on President Trump in a recent book, we're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Dave, they say that Washington is the city of second chances. For me personally, I'm not sure that that's true. But do you think it's true for Steve Bannon, or do you think he's done?
I think he's right out there with Gary Hart. no second chances. No, he sort of gave it up and showed how bad this was for him when he tried to apologize and get back in Trump's good graces, which was blown off. This is not a guy with a history of making apologies. He's somebody who actually has trashed people for making apologies. It's like a sign of weakness. So, yeah, I think for him to grovel and, you know, take things back, like saying that Don Jr.'s a good guy.
Yeah, it's unbecoming, and it's not really Bannon style. And you would think that somebody who has been as close to Donald Trump as Steve Bannon has would know that what you do in a situation like that is that you double down. You don't back off. And I think, frankly, if he had doubled down, maybe the Trumps would have had a little bit more respect for him.
We paid so much attention to Bannon as if he, you know, I think Donald Trump probably... The thing that got under Donald Trump Sr.'s skin the most was those Saturday Night Live skits where Bannon was portrayed as the real president, Grim Reaper. That would be like the absolute worst thing for Donald Trump, that somebody else was actually the power. And Donald Trump was sitting there at that little desk.
That's right.
And he was saying, "It's okay, Donald. It's okay. You're going to be fine." I mean, that's why Bannon started to fall out. Donald Trump doesn't want to have any other like star figures. Yeah. And Bannon is just the obvious, most famous self-promoter within the Trump campaign. When it gets down to it, a lot of it is that, I think.
And we know from the, what's the annual press get together where all the swells talk about how funny they are and how great they are. The annual Washington Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah,
we know. Yeah, we know from that Trump has zero sense of humor.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
I'm sure that when he saw that Saturday Night Live skit, he saw that as an attack on his presidency.
Yeah, and also he probably, given who he is, probably really thought Bannon is loving this because, you know, it does look like he's the power behind the throne and the throne is nothing.
Well, he's kind of intimated a number of times, and lately he was getting delusions of grandeur talking about running for president and stuff, you know, and running candidates against the Republican incumbents and things like that. So, you know, he really definitely was showing signs of megalomania.
But the other part of the story, there are different parts, and maybe ultimately Steve Bannon is just sort of a footnote in history, nothing, no really big deal. Everybody was all up in arms about Steve Bannon one way or the other. But the other part of the story is what he actually said to Michael Wolff, which he said, "You're going to have Manafort and Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. take a meeting with a lawyer from Russia who the Robert Goldstone or Rob Goldstone, the promoter who's their friend, said had dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russians. And Trump Jr. says, oh, I love it. And then they meet with her. And that's not what the meeting was about from her point of view. But they took the meeting hoping to get dirt on Hillary Clinton from Russians at Trump Tower with no lawyer present. So in one way, Bannon was probably just speaking what he actually felt in that interview with Michael Wolff. Why? I don't know, because obviously Donald Trump Sr. would eventually read that. But in fact, that's the other part to the story. And in some ways, it gets lost a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I mean, as a reporter who has interviewed people in Washington a lot and interviewed, you know, business people who are full of themselves, one of the things I've learned is if you talk with somebody long enough who has these kinds of, self-images as being really powerful, they do kind of forget that, that they have vulnerability, and they talk to you, you know, and especially if you're doing it repeatedly, they forget after a while to say, this is off the record, and protecting themselves.
Right. Which happens all the time.
It's very common. And then they'll come back and say, oh, by the way, that was off the record. And then you just have to say, no, it wasn't. That's not how it works.
Yeah. I mean, these are egomaniacs, megalomaniacal figures.
Yeah.
And they want, somebody's going to write a book about them and make them like forever famous and forever the most important person in the room.
Yeah, and they forget that they don't really have control of the outcome of that.
That's right.
And they kind of think they do. So, you know, it's in keeping that he would have sort of, you know, he was wanting to glorify himself to this reporter. And, you know, he thought that's how it would be done, how it would be recorded. But, a lot is context.
Dave, what does this do to some of these alt-right candidates running for Senate? I'm thinking specifically of places like Mississippi, Nevada, possibly Arizona. And what does this do to Breitbart as an organization? Since the death of Andrew Breitbart, Bannon has been the guy. He's been the leader, the figurehead. He's been a massive presence in the newsroom there.
Hopefully it'll be the end of it.
And he is obviously a guy who's, you know, organizationally competent and also he's smart. So I suspect that he's the brains behind the outfit. And so that's going to hurt Breitbart a lot.
He's rich, John.
He is indeed.
And so even though the Mercers, the billionaire Mercer family, has cut him off because of these comments. By the way,
right,
they were cutting off Bannon, I think, earlier because Bannon sort of pretending to be a populist, a right-wing populist, instead of just a right-winger.
Right.
He said that he wanted to have extra taxes on multimillionaires.
Right.
And mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not music to the ears of the Mercer family or the other billionaire backers of Donald Trump. So They were moving away from him, but Bannon himself is a banker.
Yeah, he's a career banker.
That's right. Well, again, I don't know how many years he had as a banker.
But he was in Goldman Sachs. He was Goldman Sachs. He made a lot of money.
I think he was a short-timer there, but...
He did some Hollywood...
It was Larry David.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so, Larry David made
anyway,
him rich.
With money, you could come back. The problem is Bannon was trying to present a political brand, which is... I'm more Trump than Donald Trump.
That's
I'm
right.
The real thing. I'm
That's
the authentic
right.
Right-wing populist. I'm going to lead the insurgency against the Republican Party establishment. Any Republican Party, in quote, insurgent, even to the right of the Republican establishment, which is, you know, it's hard to be to the right of the Republican establishment, but they are. Why would they take Stephen Bannon on as their new coach? I think he's finished in that sense, at least in the short term.
Well, he also was a bust in Alabama.
Yeah, sure was. But you know what, though? He was a bust. He was a bust nationally, too. I mean, I'm going to compare him again to Karl Rove. Here's a guy who essentially lost the presidential election by 3 million votes, right? This is the campaign that Bannon led. They lost by 3 million votes. The only other campaign that he's ever been involved in is the Alabama Senate race, which he lost in spectacular fashion.
Yeah, that's pretty hard to do.
And that's hard to do, exactly. So, you know, who is it that has convinced so many Americans that Bannon is some sort of a political genius? He's not. He's Karl Rove, but he's not even as good at it as Karl Rove.
And Karl Rove is not good.
I think it played well in the liberal media.
Yes.
To
he was an easy
Bengali. Well, they liked the idea that there was this Bengali that was, you know, manipulating Trump and, you know, making his mouth move, which was somewhat true, but, you know, it made a nice storyline.
And superficial as all get out, because here you have, I mean, that's the thing. The Democrats are ranting and railing against Bannon, who I would as well. But bottom line is, like, when that military budget came before the Congress, the one that we talked about in the last episode, the Democrats and the Republicans, liberal, conservative, they were all behind the same military budget. In other words, by hyper-focusing on personalities and the outrageous, awful Steve Bannon, a big part of the population thinks they're doing something progressive when, in fact, there's kind of a passive acceptance of the reality that the bipartisan establishment is the problem right now.
Yeah, that's right. And that's been going on for years, that you know, both sides are pro-military, pro-empire.
Yeah. We're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. He's an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Dave, I would say we're going to continue to follow this story, but we just don't know if Steve Bannon, in fact, will be a story very much longer. ThisCan'tBeHappening.net is the website you should go to find the writings of Dave Lindorf. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
At least 15 people have been killed in the exclusive Southern California enclave of Montecito after mudslides triggered by heavy rains followed the worst forest fires in the state's history, which destroyed houses and roads. Yet many Republicans still deny the effects of climate change. We're joined from Oakland, California by May Bouvey. She's the executive director of 350.org. And from Ventura, California by Tomas Rebecci, the senior Central Coast organizer for Food and Water Watch. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Tomas, let's start with you. You are on the ground there in Ventura County. Can you tell us what the situation's like in Montecito today?
Yes, definitely. First responders are having more time to actually go through the rubble today and see if they can find more survivors. Yesterday, there was still heavy rain throughout the day, so they had to cut short some of their rescues. But at this point, the death toll, they're saying, is expected to rise above the current count of 15. But we, over here in Ventura County, too, we were under some voluntary evacuations. Recently, my family, too, we'd been evacuated for the past three weeks for the Ventura fires, and we actually live near here, Hillside, too. But we weren't into the voluntary evacuation, but we were hosting some of our neighbors who were the past two nights. So we're still very uneasy here and throughout the Ventura and Santa Barbara area over the next couple weeks when we think some more heavy rainstorms might be coming in.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear this. So what we have, for our listeners who aren't familiar with the area, we're talking about really what is one of the most exclusive areas in the entire country. It's often called the American Riviera. The houses are multi-million dollar houses. The scenery is stunning. But what we've had is weeks of forest fires, wildfires, and indeed the Thomas Fire is now classified as the worst fire in the history of the state of California. And then as soon as the fire goes out, these heavy rains begin. I think you've gotten something like 5 inches of rain in the last 2 days, then causing massive mudslides that just push houses right off of their foundations. May Bouvey, is this something that Californians are going to have to get used to?
Well, it is absolutely the case that we're having a horrific fire season and now mudslides as a result. You know, I live in Northern California and grew up in Sonoma, which also suffered from a major fire this year. And as soon as the heavy rain started this week, my first thought was, oh no, we're going to start to see a ton of mudslides all of a sudden. So it's devastating what's happening. And this is what we can predict with climate change. Climate change creates ideal settings for fire.
they're amplifying the threat of wildfires. And when you have these barren hillsides and heavy rains, that's when you see these ideal conditions for mudslides. So we know what is causing these problems, and we know what can be done to stop it. And I think that's really important for people to understand, is when we talk about climate change, we know it is here with us right now, but it is not too late to make the kind of policy shifts that have to be made. We know we need to transition off of fossil fuels into clean energy. And so my hope for people who are seeing what's happening, experiencing it firsthand, people don't lose hope that there's actually a lot we still know how to do.
You know, and I'm wondering too, if you've got a president in the White House who just refuses to accept even the premise of climate change, and in fact mocks the idea of climate change on Twitter, and a Congress that supports that ill-conceived position, is there anything that the rest of us can do in the meantime until we're able to elect leaders that are willing to make these broad policy changes? May, let's start with you, and then I'd like to hear what Tomas has to say.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we've seen since the election of Donald Trump is a real resurgence in local activism. And this isn't just in the case of the climate movement. We're seeing this in many, many movements fighting for equality and social justice. But in the climate movement, people are fighting to make their communities fossil free. They're passing resolutions to go to 100% renewable energy. They're divesting. Today, there was a very significant announcement from the city of New York about divesting their pension funds from all fossil fuels. So this is one of the incredible things about climate change, is we can actually impact what's happening at the local level if we do enough of it and we do it quickly. So I would encourage people listening to get involved in local efforts to transition their communities off of the dirty energy economy, and get involved in any number of really inspiring climate activist opportunities, because nobody is taking the election of a crazy climate denier sitting down.
Tomas, go ahead.
I agree. There is a lot that can be done at the local level. And also here in the statewide level, I think it's not just enough for our leaders to believe in climate change. They have to actually act on it. Like our Governor Jerry Brown, he talks a good game too, but as we've seen under his two terms, he's taken over $10 million from the fossil fuel industry, has expanded oil drilling throughout California. And now he's talking tough with the Trump administration about offshore drilling, because they're going to open up federal waters to drilling, but he's actually expanded offshore drilling in state waters by over 17% with 238 new wells under his administration. So we need to keep our local leaders accountable by new expansion of fossil fuel projects like we're doing here in Ventura County, where we're actually the third largest producer of oil and gas in the state. And now we're trying to even expand this. We're constantly fighting new wells in our own neighborhoods. And a lot of these wells, just like here in Ventura, are in some of the most vulnerable low-income Latino communities. So
yeah,
we need to be fighting back in our communities, but also at the state level, and keep our own leaders accountable. When they talk a good game, we got to make sure that they follow that up.
May, what's the mood there? What's the mood in California? Obviously there's a lot of consciousness in California about climate change. Perhaps it's one of the leading places in the country, but it's all coming home right now in such a way, such a devastating way, such a catastrophic way, and not is it with something that, you know, that came and went in a day or two. This is just a continuum of interrelated catastrophes. What's the mood?
I think people are definitely discouraged, because this is why people in California started to seek out really aggressive climate policy early on. And this is why there's been so much effort in this state to try to move beyond fossil fuels. Tomas is exactly right about the pressure that is being applied on the governor to really be the kind of climate leader we want him to be, including saying no to oil drilling. So I think it's challenging to be in a place where people have put so much on the line to try to avoid exactly what's happening right now. You can't get past that fact. And with the increasing severity of climate disasters this year, not just in California, but all over the world, it is very sobering. But this is what we expected to happen. And so in many ways, I think it's bringing people together. It's attracting more people to be part of this movement, who are starting to see what's happening and realizing climate change isn't a problem for future generations only. It's a problem for right now. And we're getting a lot more interest in being part of the climate movement. So there is also that aspect of what's happening.
That's the voice of May Bouvie. You can go to her organization's website, 350.org, if you want to learn more, and especially if you want to get involved. And also, we're speaking with Thomas Rebecci. He is with Food and Water Watch. You can look at his website at foodandwaterwatch.org. May Bouvie, what's going to happen in the coming days? Tomas was pretty pessimistic. Are the mudslides going to continue? Is there any possibility that they wouldn't under these circumstances?
It seems pretty likely, given the destruction the fires have caused, that we're going to see more dangerous mudslides. And it's important to remember that the Thomas Fire, which is the record-breaking fire in Southern California, still isn't 100% contained. So it's this perverse situation of mud falling, heavy rains while a fire is burning. And this is climate change. This is the kind of catastrophic impact of all of the fossil fuel burning that we have expected to see happen. So I hope people are taking precautions to be safe, following evacuation orders. And for those of us who are not impacted in this time, that we're doing everything we can to prevent the worst effects of climate change.
May, what can visitors to your website do to help your organization, to try to help the people of California? Again, you're at 350.org. Can you tell our listeners what they can do to help?
So if you're listening right now and you want to be part of this movement, we welcome you. And if you visit our website, you can sign up to be part of getting your community to go fossil free. And this is a campaign that's happening all over the world, because it's actually not enough for just one community to take part. We all have to be involved for the scale of this crisis. So that's part of joining a local group, attending a meeting, getting your mayor to make a commitment. These are all things you can do. But we also hope that you'll go on to Facebook and Twitter and share content, share videos about climate change, and talk to your neighbors about this issue. If you're passionate about this, chances are you know someone who isn't necessarily connecting the dots between extreme weather and climate change. So we hope you'll use your voice to help connect those dots and build the movement that we need. There are also numerous organizations working throughout the state of California who are led by people who are being impacted first and worst by climate change. So we also encourage organization that you can participate with.
That was the voice of May Bouvie, the executive director of 350.org. She joined us from Oakland, California. And we were also joined from Ventura, California by Tomas Rebecci, the senior Central Coast organizer for Food and Water Watch. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen, filed a federal lawsuit today against the news organization BuzzFeed and against Fusion GPS over the allegations contained in the Steele dossier. We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese, the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Kevin, this seems like the actions of a crybaby. I hate to say it, but filing a lawsuit against a news organization, and then today the president called for a liberalization of libel laws to make it even easier to sue news organizations. What in the world is going on here?
Well, they'd have to make it easier because this lawsuit is probably not going to go anywhere. when this was published, they said this was unverified and it contained inaccuracies. So I think right from there, to call this an intentional false communication to harm someone's reputation, you know, if they say from when they publish it, this has not been verified and contains inaccuracies, they're pretty much saying, you know, read this with a grain of salt. So I don't think there's much lawsuit here. And the lawsuit against the firm that paid for it, you know, they just had documents released yesterday by Dianne Feinstein from their testimony before the Senate committee. And in that testimony, they said that there's nothing, you can't say these are false. These are just field reports from interviews done with people who had knowledge of various source information. So I think this is a crazy lawsuit, and it could actually, again, backfire, because it gives the opportunity for those who are sued to say, hey, this is true.
Yeah.
And then, you know, show why it's true. So I don't get it. It's these attempts, I don't know what he's trying to do. Maybe maybe he's really feeling like his law business is down because of this, and he's doing something to try to say, hey, I'm not part of this whole Russia conspiracy. I don't know.
You know, that's actually a point that I hadn't considered. Maybe he's doing it to save himself. Who knows?
But he's doing it on behalf of Trump.
Right.
Well, it's not clear. He's not doing this as Trump's lawyer. He's doing this as himself.
Oh, I see.
He is Trump's lawyer, but he's doing it because it hurt him.
Well, let's say, and you're not making the prediction that this would happen. Let's say the lawsuit is allowed to continue. It's not dismissed summarily. Wouldn't that open Trump's lawyer to discovery from BuzzFeed? I mean, why would that be a good thing for him? I mean, that means they can go after him on everything, all of his communications. He can't assert confidentiality if he's the initiator of the lawsuit during the period of discovery, unless I'm wrong. You're the attorney, so...
No, that's exactly right. And then, of course, that'll be a decision for the judge on the breadth of discovery and all sorts of details about the discovery. But yes, it does open up, if this survives past the preliminary, you know, phase, the next question is discovery. And that could mean you could have this guy come in and take a deposition under oath. You know, and all that gets transcribed, and you know, so that becomes available, or get documents, and it could not just be BuzzFeed, but also the firm that did the research, and so, or paid for the research, and so yeah, I don't see why this is a smart move on his part.
Kevin, what would have to be the basis of something like this? What would Cohen have to prove in order for this suit to go forward?
He had to show that the people he's accusing intentionally produced false communications, written or oral, that harmed his reputation and had damages to his business. So that's a pretty easy to prove intent on their part, that they've put out intentionally false information. I just don't see how this gets very far.
You know, and really that's the point, because the very nature of intelligence is that it's essentially rumor. I mean, it could be rumor mixed with fact, but a lot of it is rumor, or some of it's even just made up.
And you've talked about this about how it actually works.
That's right. And you have to vet your sources. Now, if you're an intelligence organization, you have the personnel and the wherewithal and the budget to vet the sources and to vet the information. That's not what the Steele dossier is. And the Steele dossier, Kevin, is, as you pointed out, made very clear that it was just based on whatever it was that these sources were saying, and that the information had not been vetted.
Yeah, so Steele goes and talks to some Russian intelligence agent or ex-agent and gives him some money, and the guy tells him a big story.
Right.
And then the guy gets money, so he's happy, and Christopher Steele's happy because he's got something. It doesn't have to be validated or verified, and that becomes the dossier. And everybody wants to buy the dossier if you're the rival of Donald Trump, whether it's Ted Cruz or Jeb Bush or then later Hillary Clinton or then maybe even James Comey.
Right.
But on top of all this issue, you mentioned vetting, the firm knew Chris Steele. They had worked with him before. Chris Steele has a reputation. And so they're not going to just like some person they have no knowledge of as far as credibility goes, but a guy who has actually a credible history. And they know what they're getting. They know they're getting field reports that, you know, need to be verified from other sources. And so I don't see what this lawsuit just does not make a lot of sense to me, except from the perspective of the guy really had his legal business hurt because he's now seen as some kind of Russian agent and he's trying to show I'm not a Russian agent. The only thing I can see.
I wonder if, and this is just pure speculation on my part, I wonder if Cohen filed this suit.
Could you set that speculation thing? Because you could be next on the lawsuit.
Yeah, right. I could be sued next. But I wonder if Cohen did this to sort of protect the dignity of his wife. And the reason I say that is
right.
And I'm looking at an NBC News report. It says here, the dossier claimed that Cohen's wife is Russian and that her father is a leading property developer in Russia, allowing Cohen to carry on a possibly criminal relationship with the Russian government. But Cohen says his wife is not Russian. She was born in Ukraine. She immigrated to the United States more than 40 years ago.
Not good enough.
And she's never been to Russia. And her father has been to Russia only once in his life and is not a Russian property developer. So I wonder if he's doing this just to get his side of the story on the record with no real expectation of winning this suit.
Mm. Interesting.
I think it's very risky if that's what he's doing. I mean, that you could find himself on the other end of a judge who's pissed off and makes and makes him pay the legal fees of the people he's accusing.
You know what? That's true. That's true.
Yeah, because if this is a frivolous lawsuit, he can get himself into some serious trouble. And Ukraine used to be part of Russia pre-Khrushchev. So I don't know what years when his wife was born.
Well, it was part of the Soviet Union, but never part of Russia.
Thank you for correcting me. Yeah, part of the Soviet Union until Khrushchev let it go independent. That's right.
Yeah. Here we have a situation that, you know, it's kind of interesting because it comes, Kevin, on the same day.
Yeah, I love that.
The same day that we got a letter of from the Department of Justice saying that we have to register as a foreign agent. And then you have another media outlet, BuzzFeed, being sued by Donald Trump's lawyer for whatever reason. And maybe it's silly and frivolous and not going to go anywhere. But it feels like there's a lot of attack and assault on media and on alternative media. And, you know, the fact of the matter is you have to raise money to defend against a lawsuit.
That's right.
Maybe BuzzFeed will become a cause celeb for the Dems right now and then get lots of money to do that. But whatever. I mean, it takes money. It takes resources. It takes time. It takes you away from journalism.
Now, and this is just what the two instances you described, the lawsuit and the letter you received, are just two examples of many in the last recent month of attack on independent media, against social media, against foreign media, against anyone who, even some corporate media gets under attack. CNN's been under attack a lot from Trump. But there's a real fear or a battle over who controls the message, you know, whose story gets out, whose story is believed. And so there's a lot going on in this area. And I think it becomes a real battleground. Radio shows, podcasts, video, live feeds, written materials. This is a new battle zone in the real resistance, not the Democrat resistance, but the real resistance.
Yeah, I think that's so important. We're emphasizing it again today, obviously, for what happened and it has been happening to us here at Sputnik. But it's going to blow back against the Democrats and the liberals who are going along with this right now because they're against Trump. But of course, we're against Trump, too. But because we're working for Sputnik or have our show platformed on Sputnik, they're going forward with this attack in the media. I want to just remind, and Mitchell and Cohen is carrying out this attack, this lawsuit against BuzzFeed. I'm going to read the First Amendment, John. I think it's always important to read the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It seems to me that in this current atmosphere, that First Amendment might start to seem just like words on a page. Go ahead, Kevin. 1 minute left.
I think they seem quaint and they're actually outdated because we have to start saying it's not just government. It's also a big business restricting our free speech. And so we have to really, I think it is actually an important document, but it's also outdated with the current reality of what we live in.
Yeah. So because he's right.
Yeah.
It's like you have free press if you have enough money to own the press.
That's what it's come down to.
We've been joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can read his writings at popularresistance.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Bruce Gagnon and 11 other protesters were arrested a year ago for blocking the main street leading to the Bath Ironworks shipyard to protest the christening of a U.S. Navy destroyer. Their trial starts soon. Bruce Gagnon joins us from Maine. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Bruce, welcome.
Hi.
Bruce, you're doing a really great thing, something that many of us, Brian and me included, urge our friends and followers to do, and that is to take it to trial. Can you give us an update on the situation for you?
Yes, just yesterday we completed jury selection out of 300 people. We, through a very long, laborious process, whittled it down to what I think will be a fairly decent jury. We got about four or five teachers, school teachers. teachers on the jury, which will be exciting because we're really looking for people that are open to hearing our stories about where these warships go, these destroyers outfitted with so-called missile defense systems that today are being deployed to encircle both Russia and China, missile defense being a key element in U.S. first strike attack planning, something that's war-gamed annually by the U.S. Space Command, a first strike attack on Russia and China. So we're going to talk about that they go, these ships go to places like Jeju Island in South Korea, where a Navy base has been built, tearing apart a 500-year-old fishing and farming village. So those kind of stories we want people locally to understand. So the trial process, I think, will help us bring that message to more and more people.
This is one of those situations, too, I think, where, well, you know, let's tell our listeners what you did. You're charged with a misdemeanor count of obstruction of a public way. Doesn't sound like a big deal, but that's not the issue here. The issue is freedom of speech and protesting war and being able to protest war and being able to raise public awareness of what our military is doing, allegedly in our name.
Yeah, and how does the public intervene in this process when you have both houses of Congress giving almost unanimous consent each and every year to an ever-expanding military budget, which, of course, the last time the U.S. mainland was invaded was the War of 1812. That was 205, now almost 206 years ago. So there's obviously some other purpose for this massive military presence on the seven seas and in 1,000 military installations. Bruce Kagnon, you're prepared to go to jail?
Yeah, well, this will be my second time. Three of us were second timers, and the state is asking for jail time. So we're definitely prepared for that. And we're already creating a list. We have a list of 40 people who are ready to do civil disobedience at the next christening, which we don't even know when it will be. But one of our goals is, as they march the Navy crew down very ceremoniously before the christening begins, they march them down the center of the street and into Bath Ironworks. We want them to be confronted by nonviolent protests, because when they go to these other countries, places like Jeju Island in Korea, there are going to be protesters there. And we want these folks to see us here in America before they go overseas. At the same time, we're also simultaneously, as we're moving towards our trial, which the date is February 1 and 2, by the way, we're also running a statewide campaign right now against General Dynamics, who owns Bath Ironworks. They're asking from our state, our very fiscally poor state of Maine, they're asking our state for $60 million in tax subsidy in the coming years. This is on top of already receiving $200 million in tax write-offs from the state of Maine since 1997. As it turns out, we've learned that since 2009, between 2009 and 2016, General Dynamics took their own profits, excess profits, in the amount of $12.9 billion, that's with a B, $12.9 billion, and bought back their own stock, driving up the price of stock, the value of the stock, giving their executives massive million-dollar bonuses and pay benefits, and at the same time squeezing the workers. They've been doing this not only in Maine, but they've been doing it in Connecticut and Rhode Island, where they also have shipbuilding facilities. And even today I learned they're doing it in Kentucky. So General Dynamics is squeezing the hell out of taxpayers at every level, local, state, and federal. And so we're running a campaign at the same time against this kind of greed, and corporate welfare.
John Kiriakou, that's an important point that Bruce is making, because the idea of national security is always about protecting the country, protecting the people. The mantra is that's the first and foremost duty of any president. But beneath that rhetoric, underneath that rhetoric, the reality is that this is a business. This is a rat hole through down which huge parts of the national treasury are are sent, and it's really for the benefit of the 1%. It's for the benefit of the military-industrial contract. I mean, they have to justify it somehow. They can't say, look, we want to loot the country. They have to say sure. it's in the name of protecting the country.
And that's why the 9/11 attacks were a gift to the military-industrial complex. You know, we've said this before, Brian, on this show. I'll say it again. It's no coincidence that the highest concentration of millionaires per capita in America is in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And that is because so-called defense contractors or intelligence community contractors have gotten rich off of this. You know, when a hawkish president of the United States like Donald Trump sends a proposed Pentagon budget to Capitol Hill and it comes back with 40-something billion dollars more than he asked for, you know you have a problem. When you spend more money than the next 8 countries combined, or whatever it is, on national defense, there's a problem. Because this isn't national defense. This is, as you say, a get-rich-quick scheme by the 1% and the defense contractors.
Yeah, and if anybody protests against it, like Bruce and these other heroic folks have done, they're labeled as either the fringe or unpatriotic, something like that.
You know, may I add something, too,
yeah.
about Bruce? This is from the Bangor Daily News in Bangor, Maine. And it says that that two of the people charged with Bruce took a plea. They took a guilty plea, and they were ordered to make a $140 donation to the United Way. Okay? So that tells you how serious the prosecutor sees this case. But in Bruce's case, because he's not willing to play ball and walk away quietly, they're seeking jail time. Are the American people safer with Bruce Gagnon in jail?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Go ahead, Bruce.
Just one thing I want to say, one thing more about this $60 million corporate welfare subsidy that General Dynamics is asking for. Maine has a very small population, about 1.3 or 1.4 million people. And in our state today, we have 43,000 children living in poverty. And what's interesting is that in my community, I live in Bath, and where the shipyard is, our two state representative and senator are the co-sponsors of this bill to give them this money. They're both Democrats. And so the Democrats, ostensibly, we're told, are out there supporting the poor, supporting small businesses. But the fact is, they're carrying water for one of the fifth largest weapons corporation on the entire planet Earth. It's just unbelievable. And we have to stand up protest against this. We have to protest these christenings of these warships because they have nothing to do with the defense of America. It's all about projecting power internationally on behalf of corporate interests.
Yeah. Bruce, we have 2 minutes left. I'm looking at the same website that John is, the Bangor Daily News, the paper there where you are. One of this paragraphs reads, the 2016 protest kindled memories, that's your protest, the one you're going on trial for in February, kindled memories of the 1997 demonstration that landed peace activist Philip Berrigan in a Bath jail cell. Talk about Phil Berrigan and his impact on you and the impact of the Berrigan brothers on this continuing legacy of people bearing witness or carrying out civil disobedience against the war machine.
Berrigan led two plowshares actions at Bath Iron Works here over the years. The first time they dropped the charges because they didn't want any bad publicity. So he and others came back and did it again. The second time he went to jail. There's a really strong memory in Maine about that action. It really moved a lot of people to begin focusing on Bath Iron Works because it's such a big employer in the state, the largest industrial employer in the state. It's the best paying industrial job in the state of Maine. It's a union job. Just about everybody. Well, we started with 300 person jury pool, and half of them had a relative or themselves working at Bath Iron Works or retired Navy. And so this whole community just reeks with that consciousness and with that history. And so to stand up against Bath Iron Works has always been, you just don't do it. A lot of progressive people won't come to a protest at Bath Iron Works because it's controversial. They'd rather go all the way to Washington, D.C. I call them out-of-town peace activists, you know. So Phil Berrigan really opened that door for people in Maine, and it's a door that still has a crack in it, and we're trying to keep pushing on it.
We're going to keep following the story, of course. Bruce Gagnon's trial begins in the beginning of February. Bruce, we hope you will come back, but we are out of time for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM or 1390 AM. You can hear us every day at SputnikNews.com, or you can subscribe to us as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear. We'll be right back.